Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud. And we've got a lot of content to go through. Let me see here. We've kind of covered the Whiskey Rebellion. We've covered the bank. We've covered the assumption. One thing we've never covered before is the Republican Party. And so technically, this show should be airing on Tuesday, tomorrow, but this is actually going to be Monday's the 16th. So we're doing this show to establish the Republican Party because starting tomorrow, we're going to be reading the Constitution because it's Constitution Day.
Awesome.
Ah, now we get to dive into that. Well, I was hoping that we'd have time to get into the resolutions, but we didn't. But that's okay. And we're going to really try to get through the Constitution as fast as possible because there's so much other content that we need to go through. But we're not going to skimp on, you know, details that I think are really important. So we're going to approach it also tomorrow. We're going to approach it differently. We're going to identify violations as well as identifying what the clause is. What is this? Is this a power? Is it a role? Is it a responsibility? Because based on what that clause is, helps you understand that, you know, okay, so this is a standard, but that doesn't mean Congress can start making laws regarding the eligibility of candidates. Right? So when we go through this, it'll hopefully help you understand the Constitution better than you've ever learned from Hillsdale College or anywhere else.
That's what I'm hoping.
There you go. There you go. So as we dive into, we're diving into this thing called the Republican Party. And one of the things, and the reason why this is important, is because today, as we look at the Republican Party, we actually see how everybody thinks that the Republican Party was founded by Abraham Lincoln, or actually, you know, he was the one that made it great. When the reality is, and I've said this before, the reality is that Jefferson and Madison, and technically it was Madison that founded the Republican Party. And most people call it today, if you go to Wikipedia, they'll talk about it as the Democratic hyphen Republican Party. That is not correct. It was called the Republican Party. And as a matter of fact, what we're going to do, because we'll start off with me providing a citation instead of having all these different documents open on Tammy's desk, I think it'd just be easier for me to do this. And so in Madison's notes on nullification, in the 25th paragraph, and you'll find this on page 4, 25th paragraph, because I actually have them numbered, this is what he says, and he talks about, you know, these, you know, what they were doing, but this is where he points out that he formed the Republican Party. He didn't call it the Democratic Republican. He called it the Republican Party. So this is what he says. It must be recollected that this document proceeded from representatives chosen by the people some months after the resolutions had been before them, with a longer period for manifesting their sentiments before the report was adopted and without any evidence of disapprobation in the constituent body. On the contrary, it is known to have been received by the Republican Party a decided majority of the people with the most entire approbation. Received by the Republican Party. Now, he talks about republicanism and so forth in here, but bottom line, when it comes down to the fact that you have literally a party and the Republican Party, he's, you know, because he uses the term party as parties to the compact and so forth, But when it came to the fact that he mentions once the fact that they actually formed and it was received by that very specific party. Now, there's one other reference, and this is on paragraph 61. So it's way down in the document, but this is where he talks about the Republican Party again. But it's an abbreviated use of the word Republican, R-E-P-U-B-N, but he was using shorthand. You know, these were his notes. And so this is what he said. But as a question of fact, the decision must be safely left to the recollection of those who were contemporary with the crisis and to the researches of those who were not, taking for their guide the reception given to the proceedings by the Republican Party everywhere. So in 1798, 1799, and 1800, this entity called the Republican Party was a real thing. It was called the Republican Party. Now, one more little point of fact, I would call anybody to read Jefferson's inaugural address of 1801. What he said to the people of America is, he said, "We're all Republicans. We were all Federalists," in a unifying speech to basically say, hey, regardless of your party affiliation, we're all Americans. But he called one party the Republicans, not the Democratic, not the Jeffersonian, the Republicans, and the other party, the Federalists. And the Federalists ended up becoming the Democrats. But the way they rewrote history is, oh, well, the Democratic Republicans, Jefferson was really the first Democratic president. And that is a big lie. There's all sorts of lies out there regarding Jefferson. If you think, because one of the lies is that he's deist. Most people think that Jefferson did not believe in Christ. He wasn't Christian. There's absolutely evidence that proves that wrong. And for you to really understand Jefferson's spiritual positions, you have to dive through his letters back and forth between him and John Adams as they were mending their friendship and really exposing their soul to what they really felt and why they did what they did and so forth. And it was kind of an amazing turn of events as these men were able to, you know, put aside their differences and, you know, become friends again. Anyway, all that being said, we now have this document that I kind of put together. Because what I did, folks, is I said, well, let's work out the fact that Madison actually did find the Republican Party. This was based on a conversation and a trip up to Massachusetts with Madison and Jefferson. And so Madison went off and created this Republican Party. Jefferson was a little busy as the Secretary of State at that point in time. So we have the link in this document, and we also have the link. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to provide you the PDF of the printout of all of the stuff regarding the Republican Party from the Library of Congress. The reason why this is important is because I've already noticed that Tar Fox and some other information is being expunged from the internet. What that means is the acknowledgement that the federal government did all of this testing and development and innovation on chemtrails back in the 1900s, 1990s. Well, they're expunging that from the internet. That was a joint venture between NASA and the University of Washington. And it actually gave you why they were doing this. They were looking at prevailing winds of how they could, you know, keep particulates afloat in the atmosphere. Yes. And so those types of documents are actually going away. I knew this was going to happen. And eventually, artificial intelligence is actually going to start editing and slowly drifting and changing source documents and so forth.
Yeah.
Because the big lie has to be strengthened and basically buoyed up so that when we finally, you know, when people finally challenge, they read this and they go and it doesn't say what it used to say. It says what they want it to say. And that's where we're at. This is all the big setup for the big deception, for the big kill, because a lot of us have to die, and we can either accept our fate to die, or we can start fighting back and maybe pull America back from the brink. And we have a lot of things we can do with that. And if we have time today, I'm going to expose how the states, how there's seven states that could actually thwart what Schumer's doing in the Senate. We can talk about that more. But if not, we'll talk about it during the discussion on the Constitution. But without any further ado, go ahead. And what day was the party founded? It doesn't have the actual day there, but it has the year.
Yeah,
1792. Okay, so this is all about the same time frame of the Whiskey Rebellion, the banks, and all of these things were happening all about that same time. So obviously, Madison and Jefferson said, hey, you know, we're not in Kansas anymore, Toto. We better start doing some things because, you know, things are getting away from us very quickly. Hamilton was two steps ahead of these guys. Okay. So the Britannica basic blurb in defining it is what? Go ahead.
Just a little blurb under that?
Yeah, with that little paragraph. This is their exclamation here.
Yeah, the Republican Party in U.S. history, political party formed from the nucleus of the Anti-Federalists and the county's first opposition party, formed in 1792 by supporters of Thomas Jefferson in opposition to the Federalist Party of Alexander Hamilton. The party developed into the Democratic Republican Party, 1798, and was the forerunner of the modern Democratic Party.
Okay, so see, this is the political correct spin here. Now, let's see how over the course of the next, I don't know how many pages this is, but it's four pages. But over the course, I've actually highlighted every little blurb where Congress and the Library of Congress in their politics, American history, politics and history of the United States, where they talk about the Republican Party. So let's go ahead and say start off with James Madison, the father of the Constitution.
Okay, so this first one by Britannica, that one's correct?
Well, no, that's the politically correct version.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Okay, so Library of Congress, James Madison, father of the Constitution. James Madison, 1751 to 1838, an Orange County, Virginia planter shown in his portrait by Charles Wilson Peel, was a strong proponent of strong central government to replace the Articles of Confederation. Often credited with being the father of the Constitution of 1787, Madison established the Jeffersonian Republican Party with Thomas Jefferson, and in 1809 succeeded him as president of the United States.
Right, these are just kind of little blurbs over little points of events. Okay, so location of capital spurs partisan bickering. Go ahead.
In July 1790, Congress decided to move the capital of the federal government from New York to a new city to be built in the District of Columbia, created from parts of Maryland and Virginia on the Potomac River, with a 10-year interim in Philadelphia. The location of the capital was part of a critical compromise over funding of national and state debts. The Compromise of 1790 became a focal point for the emerging Federalists and Republican parties.
Hold on here. They didn't say Jeffersonian Republican. See?
Yeah.
Okay. See, you know, it helps to be consistent. AI would have actually had that consistent. But go ahead.
The print satires the profit opportunities presented by the traveling capital.
Uh-huh. Now, partisan clash over creating national bank. There you go.
One of the early critical differences between Federalists and Republicans was a disagreement on the implied powers of the Constitution to allow for creation of a national bank. Secretary of State Thomas Jefferson advocated a narrow construction of the Constitution that would have prohibited a national bank. Secretary of the Treasury Alexander Hamilton supported the bank with a broad interpretation of the Constitution's implied powers under the General Welfare Clause. President Washington sided with Hamilton.
There you go. Okay, so what did they use there? Were they consistent?
Federalists and Republicans.
It mentions the Republicans, not Jeffersonian Republicans. Okay. Keep going. With Washington tries to pacify the parties.
As party lines were drawn in the new federal government, President George Washington tried to pacify the parties by addressing the chief protagonists, Alexander Hamilton, his Secretary of the Treasury, and Thomas Jefferson, his Secretary of State. Although both Hamilton and Jefferson promised to work together, the struggle between the Federalists and the Republican parties continued unabated.
Huh. So it wasn't Hamilton Federalists, Jefferson Republicans. It was the Federalists and the Republicans. The two-party system at the time was the... Because, again, they didn't label, they didn't hyphenate, because the hyphenation only creates a specification to what they want you to perceive. Why would you actually create... I mean, today, just my demeanor, I always try to limit, you know, using extra words. If I have to write and I want to be accurate, I write what I need to write. But if I was going to create a party, I wouldn't make it long. If I'm going to create a business name, I wouldn't want to make it long, because people would have a hard time having to say that all the time. You know, they just struggle. You know, the fatigue of saying it. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah.
And so it makes no sense at all why they would have hyphenated the Republican Party. Makes no sense at all. And the fact that it was all over the place, the Jeffersonian, because that's what we really have seen. Some people referred to it as the Jeffersonian Republicans, but where in the heck did the Democratic Republicans come from? And yeah. I know this because during the presidential campaigns, Jefferson was spoken about Republican and the Republican Party. He was being challenged to say, you know, it seems like you guys don't respect the democracy. And he goes, no, the Republicans, we're a Democratic Republicans. So in other words, he used it as an adjective to help people understand that Republicans support the democratic process.
Right.
And that's where it basically took, it's just like this wall of separation between church and state, where it was a letter that Jefferson expressed out to the Danbury Baptists in thanking him for basically supporting religious freedom. And he just said, well, I always felt that there should be a... I felt, not the law states, I always felt that there should be a wall of separation. Well, Jefferson is not the law. The Constitution is the law.
Right.
And regardless of how Jefferson felt, he should not have begotten law. The only way that law could have been gotten is for the states to amend the Constitution with 3/4 of the states ratifying. If not, it's just a quip of Jefferson in a letter to the Danbury Baptist. And they've been exploiting that crap, and they use that all the time as a way to prosecute their war against us. Anyway, so, all right. Now, the Republican Party, christened by James Madison. Now, remember, Jefferson, they claim Jefferson started it, but what do you see here?
In September 1792, James Madison coined the term Republican Party in an essay, A Candid State of Parties, published in the National Gazette of Philadelphia. Although the Jeffersonian Republican Party drew strength from the Anti-Federalists, no one had more claim to the authorship of the federal constitution that did Madison, one of the founders of the Jeffersonian Republican Party.
See that? They have to keep on. Now they want to put it in there to, you know, kind of make you understand it's not the Republican Party. Please don't look at it that way. We don't want you to look at it that way. Because if all of a sudden the Republicans in America acknowledge that, you know what, the original intent, and what was the original intent of this party? It was a limited and defined government. Because right now, the Republican Party, rhinos, and conservatives are all over this conserving government as it is. What does conservative mean? To keep things the way they are, right? Right? If you look, up the word conservative.
That's true. Yeah.
While I talk, you go ahead, but look up the word. What is the definition of conservative? Bottom line, that word is designed to basically express the desire to keep what we have. And my point is, I don't think keeping what we have will keep us alive. I think if we keep what we have, we're destined to die. We are going at neck-break speed, spending money and having a government that is destroying us. We got to get away from conserving.
Maybe we need to call it the Restoration Party.
Well, you see my point, though? When you really look at conservative, well, how did that become a good name? Actually, when you look at the word progressive is actually a very good name, and it has nothing to do with the communist movement. That's not progressive. That's regressive.
Yeah.
Communist movement is very destructive. It's centralizing control. It is draconian. There is nothing progressive about the communist movement. To me, progressive imbues enlightenment. Okay. So yeah. Anyway, okay, so the Jay's treaty now. They went off and had this treaty, and Jay comes back licking his wounds. But anyway, what do they say about this regarding the party?
Faced with British refusal to vacate Western frontier forts as well as honor neutral shipping rights, President George Washington sent Supreme Court Chief Justice John Jay to London in 1794. The resulting treaty, which failed to resolve the issues but prevented a war with Great Britain, was extremely unpopular with the Jeffersonian Republicans.
Now, it wasn't even hyphenated there. Didn't even hyphenate it. So the inconsistency kills me, but keep going.
The Treaty of Amity, Commerce, and Navigation was quickly labeled Jay's Treaty and became a lightning rod for the political parties and a point of contention between the president and Congress over funds for its implementation.
There you go. Okay, so the last one before we go into break, a champion to challenge Alexander Hamilton.
In this letter, Thomas Jefferson challenged James Madison to enter the pamphlet wars against his political rival, Federalist Alexander Hamilton, whom he asserted is really a colossus to the anti-Republican Party. There is nobody but yourself who can meet him, urged Jefferson.
And so, and this is the truth. If people actually really read some of these books and so forth, Jefferson's had such respect for Madison because he was so literate. He was probably the most literate person in America. Now, there were a lot of people that were really bedazzled by Hamilton because Hamilton was a forked-tongued snake oil salesman and was very good. He was a soothsayer, very good. But when it came to providing such a broad defense of empirical data, Madison was the best. There were many times where people would describe Madison as when he stepped up to address the House or what have you in debate, he would have a stack of books that was so intimidating, the whole room kind of shook, when he put them down. And then he would go through every single one of those books. Remember when we read about the Bank Act and how he literally picked up the ratification debates and read from three of them? He was not one to shy from providing the actual words, which, folks, this is one of the biggest reasons why we go through the words by detail, because we're going into break here. But this is the real reason why we read these things, because you could take, I could editorialize. You could just say, yeah, whatever he said. But if you hear these words, you can understand how powerful they are. And then you yourself can be equally empowered and equally of a statesman as Jefferson and the rest of these men. This is how we get empowered. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so as we were kind of going through all of this, one of the things that just absolutely amazes me is the power of these guys' words. And as Jefferson, Madison, Iredell, doesn't matter, even Hamilton, you know, when you actually read exactly what they said, then you can see, you know, the context and subtext to some of those things. Like when we were reading those letters from Madison and Hamilton during the ratification debates, you could read that subtext that Hamilton needed to know the lowdown so that he could start publishing these letters. That there's no doubt in my mind, he probably had these things stuffed, waiting to actually inject these things. That as time came along, he goes, oh, you know, I need to massage this so that the court, so the judiciary, the federal judiciary, will be able to usurp more power and be able to be far more active than this dead court that it was designed to be. Because our court system was designed to be passive. It had no ability to reach out and grab cases the way Marshall did with judicial review. In other words, their job is to sit there and wait for the cases to come. And bottom line, they should be handling all cases. The fact is, all cases within their jurisdiction. But see, they don't challenge, or there's no clarity regarding jurisdiction. They don't challenge anything. Everything, if it's coming to them, they just accept jurisdiction. And that's one of the big problems, because they're dealing with all sorts of things that they have no jurisdiction over. But secondly, as they create this huge backlash of, you know, all of these cases that they just can't handle, now it gives them the freedom to cherry pick those that meet the agenda that they want to push forward.
Right.
And this is how they've been doing this. They've been manipulating us big time, and they've been making bank over all of this. But anyway, we're going through the Republican Party, the establishment of the Republican Party. And so a champion to the challenger, Alexander Hamilton, Jefferson, this is what you just read, that how Jefferson urged Madison to start taking up pamphlets and writing pamphlets to attack Hamilton. And Hamilton got frustrated because Madison was good. Go ahead. Congress at odds.
Okay. This print captures the heated partisan debates in Congress between Vermont's Jeffersonian Republican Representative Matthew Lyon and Connecticut's Federalist Representative Roger Griswold. They attacked each other with a cane and fireplace tongs on the floor of the House of Representatives on February 15, 1798. Griswold had accused Lyon of cowardice during the American Revolution, and Lyon responded by spitting tobacco juice in Griswold's face.
So, in other words, they started dirtying their cuffs. Okay. Political infighting and the war with France.
Abigail Adams, wife of President John Adams, feared that political infighting was endangering the United States, which was engaged in an undeclared naval war with France. Jeffersonian Republicans strongly opposed this quasi-war with France, arguing that it strengthened commercial interests and Federalist strongholds. In this letter to her nephew William Shaw, Adams saw hope in the response of the House of Representatives to the president's address to Congress.
Okay, so there was also this huge, because when you really look at the French Revolution and how it started playing out, because I think we covered this before, it really started dividing those who were Anglophiles and those who were Francophiles. Francophiles were those who supported the French, and Anglophiles supported the English. Why was it that that was even an option? Why was it that people actually said, we want to support Britain? Have we not forgotten what they had done?
Yeah.
How could anybody? With the Tory acts and kicking out 100,000 Tories, loyalists to the British crown, we actually didn't even pack them up. We grabbed them and threw them out. We took their property from them. What they could carry with them, we might have allowed them to have. But they weren't taking their riches or anything else that was left behind. And whether it was looted or however they took it, I don't care. The fact is they had no right to be here. If they can't support the Constitution, they can't support liberty, and that means that we can't trust you. You have no place being here. So they kicked them out. How is it that all of a sudden it was okay to become British loyalist just 10 years later? Right? Or just a little bit more than that. All of a sudden it was just okay. We didn't see that as a perceived threat. We should have actually saw it as a perceived threat because Britain was still the ruler of the world. They were the empire. And as far as we should have been seeing this in proper context, we should have actually been very wary of all of those people who were Anglophiles.
Yeah.
Anyway, keep going. Linking Jefferson's Republicans to the French Revolution. I don't think we called that yet.
Yeah, in 1792, political pamphleteer William Cobbett settled in Philadelphia and began writing pro-English and anti-Republican articles under the pseudonym Peter Porcupine. Cobbett once described Thomas Jefferson as a deist, a Frenchman in politics and morality, and a man as much qualified to be president as I am to be an archbishop.
Okay, so back in those days, and the subtext to this is that they really wanted to have a religious test, because the reason he had a problem with Thomas Jefferson being qualified to be president was because of his religious beliefs, if you really think about it. But the bottom line is that as we look at this, it was anti-Republican, not anti-Jeffersonian Republican, right? Okay. And so depending on how they were placing context to the party, sometimes, we don't need the adjective there or the adverb. Anyway, okay, so the next one, rights of states to judge constitutionally of federal laws.
Thomas Jefferson and James Madison secretly drafted the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions to counter a perceived threat to individual liberties from the Alien and Sedition Acts. Jefferson and Madison were particularly concerned with charges of sedition brought against Republican critics of the federal government. These resolutions asserted the right of the states to judge the constitutionality of federal laws.
Okay, so you know what this is all about. We've started reading those resolutions of the Alien Sedition Acts, so you kind of understand that. But did you notice how they included Republican against Republican critics?
Mm-hmm.
Not Jeffersonian. Again, these are all excerpts off of the Library of Congress, as they kind of give you these little blurbs. What is the consistency? When you boil it down, they may have hyphenated with adverbs, you know, adjectives or what have you, but they actually, the name was very clearly, they were Republican.
Right.
Okay, but let's keep going. There's a few more here. The opposition to the Alien Sedition Acts now.
The Alien and Sedition Acts were enacted by Federalists fearful of a violent overthrow of the government as French refugees fled to the United States from revolutions in France and Haiti. The acts restricted immigration and made strong criticism of public officials illegal. Several newspaper publishers and writers were imprisoned for seditious writings. Many Americans opposed a federal sedition law, arguing that it violated the Constitution and also unconstitutionally infringed on the right to states to regular free speech through slander laws. This petition to the United States Congress was part of a Republican Party effort to repeal the Alien and Sedition Acts.
Okay, so one of the things that this is really misses, and as far as I'm concerned, the key part that they're talking about here on refugees is found in Resolution 5 of the Kentucky Resolutions. What people don't realize is that there was only 20 years where there was an allowance for states to allow citizens from other countries to be migrated. In other words, the importation of persons. In other words, if there were refugees or, you know, a large body of people, it wasn't a one person by one person act of immigration. See, immigration is when one individual wants to become a citizen of the state of Kentucky in the United States or the state of Massachusetts in the United States. In other words, when people came to America, and the way it moved after 1808, after the shutting down of the importation of persons, we went to a strict immigration system, one by one. There was only 20 years where the states were allowed for the importation of people. And this is why Jefferson put this in here, because they were literally forbidding states from being able to import Frenchmen. This is what he said, Resolution 5, that in addition to the general principle, as well as the express declaration that the powers not delegated are reserved, another and more special provision inserted in the Constitution from abundant caution has declared that, quote, the migration or importation of such persons as any of the states now exist shall think proper to admit shall not be prohibited by Congress prior to the year of 1808, close quote. This was the one window where we had an allowed refugees from France to be able to come here. And they actually were violating that part of the Constitution. So when you go through Jefferson's resolutions, he's auditing how they're deliberately and egregiously violating the Constitution directly. And so I'm pointing out that today the United States does not have the ability to importation or use the importation of people, you know, mass importation, refugees, anything like that. That power does not exist within that document. The only reason right. that they're doing it today is because we made a treaty with the UN. The UN said all states need to do this, that can do this, and the United States volunteered under the auspices of that treaty. And therefore, they've been using that as a weapon against us, and actually they've been using that to promote globalism, the concept of global citizens, and the watering down of nationalities and sovereignty of nations, trying to empower the UN for more and more. Go ahead.
No, yeah, that's interesting.
Right. Good. So as we go through the next one, let me see here. We had the importation of aliens. Now the liberal trial, I think this is the last one, right?
Actually, we need to read the second one.
Oh, the opposition to the Alien and Sedition Acts. Okay, go ahead.
Two of them. So the Alien and Sedition Acts restricted immigration and made strong criticism. Oh, did we already read that? Wait, we did.
Right.
Okay. Next one.
Right.
Libel trial of Thomas Cooper.
Uh-huh.
After attacking the administration of Federalist President John Adams in print, Thomas Cooper, political writer and ardent Republican, was tried for seditious libel against Adams before Federalist Supreme Court Justice Samuel Chase in April 1800. Cooper was found guilty, fined, and imprisoned. Republican political leaders strongly criticized Justice Chase, and he was eventually impeached, though not convicted, in 1804, after the Republicans won control of the government.
Okay.
Oh, that's it.
All right. So, anything you want to add? Anything?
Not this time.
Any questions? Anything. Okay. So, because we still have a little bit of time. We got 12 and a half minutes.
Basically, what you're saying through all of this that's written, the common word is Republican, so
yes.
That's what they were called.
Absolutely. It was Republican. Our form of government was Republican. It was an alignment to our government. This party was to basically get people to think in line with our republicanism, our representation, not a powerful judiciary, not a corporate form of government, not an executive monarchy, to understand we have a self-government system. So, as we kind of get ready to go through the Constitution, we're the charges, and I guess this would be a good time to kind of talk about this, and actually I might even bring up the Senate, because the Congress and what Schumer is doing, because I'm not sure if you're kind of aware of this, I've covered this on other shows, and I've talked about how the Senate is going down this path of, at least Schumer is going down the path of trying to change how they operate regarding, you know, their voting in the Senate and so forth. In other words, there used to be a rule that we would have this, I'll just say this blanketed 60 votes would require a passage out of the Senate. In other words, not 50% plus one, but it would require that they actually had this, I'll just say, 60% rule. That was implemented by Thomas Jefferson. And so anyway, as we go down this path, because what I'd like to do is share the screen with you, but I don't think I can because I'm having a problem with it right now. And so can you still see my screen?
I can, yeah.
You can? Okay. All right. Well,
I just see the timer stuff.
Yeah, that's fine. And I get that. So what we'll do, just to try to work around the technical difficulties we're having, folks, is I'm going to describe to you, because nobody else sees this anyway, but what I did, and I promised the audience a couple weeks ago, that I would do the due diligence and find out which states, which red states, has Democrats in their office as senator. In other words, those sycophants for Schumer. Because if they're Democrat, they're going to vote for what Schumer wants to do in undermining the Constitution. Schumer wants to actually get rid of the filibuster. He wants to get rid of the 60% rule. Everything that happens in the Senate will be 50% plus one. If it is a tied vote, with 50%, then Kamala Harris, as the unconstitutional vice president, will actually cast the deciding vote and allow it to pass, because that's how close they are in the Senate right now. Now, I did the due diligence, and I found all these states. And out of the states that we have, just so you know, folks, there are 29 hard red states. When I say hard red, I mean 29 states where the Republicans control the state legislature, both the Senate and the House. And so, as I went through and did all the due diligence, West Virginia has Manchin as an independent who may be a sycophant. Montana has a senator that is a Democratic sycophant. Ohio has a senator, so that's three, Democratic sycophant. Wisconsin, I believe, has two Democrat sycophants, so that's five. Now, Georgia has one, that's six. Arizona has one, that's seven. New Hampshire, I think, has one or two. So let's just say one, making it eight, possibly nine. And then I know Pennsylvania has two, making that 10 or 11, right? So that is a big sum. These seven states actually account for a big footprint regarding these senators' votes. Now, we've covered this before, but I go through the color-coded constitution all the time. It's the same thing as your constitution as far as languages, folks. I just use colored fonts and colored texts. And so when you go through Article 5 of the Constitution, at the very end of Article 5, it says, provided that no amendment which shall be made prior to, and then the year, taking away the slave trade, you know, undoing the stopping of the slave trade and the importation of people. See, they wanted to make it so that no state nor the federal government could import people, that we would just go to a single standard immigration system. And that's why Congress had the requirement of making a uniform rule of naturalization. That was their job. And we also covered how the fact in naturalization that the states had the real authority over naturalizing citizens. If a state said that this person can't become a citizen, the federal government couldn't trump them. Most people don't know that. And as a matter of fact, if a state actually strips a citizen of their citizenship, that automatic, the United States does it as well. Everything is reversed now. How did that happen? But anyway, back to Article 5. The 17th Amendment, let me go into the 17th Amendment, because we're going to read this again. But the 17th Amendment basically says this, that, and actually that's the 12th Amendment, not the 17th Amendment. My bad. So the 17th Amendment says this. The Senate of the United States shall be composed of two senators from each state, elected by the people thereof for 6 years, and each senator shall have one vote. The electors in each state shall have the qualifications requisite for the electors of the most numerous branch of the state legislature. When vacancies happen in the representation of any state in the Senate, the executive authority, instead of the state legislature, and instead of the state legislature appointing them, that they'll, instead of appointing, they would be elected by the people. So now it goes to the people of electing, and the in replacing, it goes to the executive, provided that the legislature of any state may empower the executive thereof to make temporary appointments until the people fill the vacancies by an election as the legislature may see fit. So that's it, right? That is it. And it is all about the process of selecting the elector. It did not say that the Senate would no longer represent the state legislature. It only stated how they were to be selected and if they had to be replaced, how that would happen. So again, going back to the Fifth Amendment. Not the Fifth Amendment, I'm sorry. Article 5. There's all these fives here. So, provided that no amendment which shall be made, that no state without its consent shall be deprived of its equal suffrage in the Senate. So in other words, just to be very, very clear, those senators are to vote according to the state legislature's desires. And if the state legislature says, we desire that we maintain the integrity of the Constitution, that you will not vote with Schumer in allowing this dismantling of this safety net of requiring 60 senators in changing your process, if you vote for that, we will recall you. We will pull you back because we consider that a violation of our right of suffrage. You have to represent us. You're there as our representatives. And if you don't, we will call you out for fail because you can't take away our representation. Again, let me read this. It says that no state without its consent, no state has yet given its consent to not be represented in the Senate. It was just implied that the 17th Amendment did that, and people stopped demanding their suffrage. Or I should say, state legislatures have stopped demanding their suffrage. Hmm. So all of a sudden, the state legislatures, if they wake up, they pull their heads out of their hinies and say, oh my gosh, we still have right to our suffrage. We will communicate with these 10 Democrats, and if they choose to vote down Schumer lines, we will pull them back. And to be very clear, they need to pass laws that basically say anything that violates their suffrage in accordance with Article 5 of the U.S. Constitution, the state legislature of the state of Montana, blah, 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 that all of these states start passing these laws to guarantee their suffrage. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. That was just a squeak.
Oh, okay. So when we look at the laws that they create, all they need to do is either make those laws as a felony or a violation of the state constitution, because they can inject it into their state constitution that they demand that their senators adhere to their votes and their suffrage, that they provide them the suffrage guaranteed under Article 5 of the U.S. Constitution. Now, why is that important? Because in Article... Which is it again? In Article talk about Article 5, using that, the Constitution. Oh, yes, I'm sorry. It's in Article 4. What's the next logical thing? Well, okay, so how do the states get them back? Right here, Article 4, Section 2. A person charged in any state with treason, felony, or other crime who shall flee from justice and be found in another state shall, on demand of the executive authority of the state from which they fled, be delivered up to be removed from the state having jurisdiction of the crime. So in other words, all they have to do is make it so that, you know, not giving them their suffrage is considered a felony and a crime and treason against the state of Montana. And therefore, you will be banned, you will be removed, and we will bring you back and extradite you and replace you. Because right there in the Constitution, the states have the right to pull these deviants who want to subvert the Constitution, who want to actually go down this path of setting us in motion of our absolute demise and collapse. We have, I say this a lot, and I hope people stop marginalizing the truth behind this. Only he knew what we were going to be facing as a nation. Only he knew what we would need in this Constitution to deal with all of these problems. And I am not amazed one bit how we have everything we need to take care of this insurgency against the Constitution, our way of life, and this great nation and republic. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.